This next segment, I got to tell you, we have a tendency on this show, I think, sometimes to get spoiled with where we start at a certain industry. This is the show where nothing is off topic. So first cartoonist we ever had in, Tom Wilson from Ziggy. First sports mascots we ever had in, San Diego Chicken and the Philly Fanatic. I mean, where do you go from there? Kind of a similar thing here, too, tonight. This is the first boxing broadcaster we've had on the show. We've had on boxing journalists before, and our good pal Rich Mancuso among them here. And I think Rich might have had something to do with helping us set this up tonight. We're very grateful to him for that. But the FDH New York Bureau, Steve Cervillo, did a great job in setting this up here for him, for us tonight to be able to get him. This gentleman, you can hear him on ESPN regularly. He's got one of the highest profile perches in the business. You can hear him during the Olympics every 4 years on NBC Sports. He's been a great trainer in the game as well, climaxing his career with the heavyweight championship of the world with Michael Moore. I can only be speaking, of course, of the one and only Teddy Atlas, who we are proud to welcome to the FDH Lounge. Teddy, good to have you on tonight, sir. How are you?
Oh, good. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we're doing fine. Thanks. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, and I know you got a lot of great things going on, and we'll talk about a lot of the different aspects of your career. I know that first and foremost, on the near horizon, you got a big event going on there. I believe it's Staten Island, is it not? And it's for the Theodore A. Atlas Foundation?
Yeah, it's the Dr. Atlas Foundation. It was founded 14 years ago in memory of my late father. He was a general practitioner doctor back in the days where GPs did everything. You know, you didn't need specialized medicine. He did. He took care of surgery. He took care of everything. And he founded two hospitals on Staten Island. One of them only had 20 beds in it to take care of people that couldn't afford hospitalization. He basically put them in the hospital for free. And he did house calls till he was 80. He was charging $5 for a house call. Half of the patients during the course of a day he didn't charge because they didn't have insurance. And he did that for, like I said, for 55 years. And I just thought that somebody who lived their life that way should be remembered. So I started this foundation 14 years ago, and I figured we'd do house calls. You know, we'll take care of the people that fall through the cracks. And we won't have any administrative costs. We'll have all volunteer. And so far, almost $4 million we've raised and given away over the 14 years. And it's directly to people that have needs, whether it's a family that has a sick child with cancer, and a lot of it is geared towards sick children. You know, they have a sick child with cancer and the insurance isn't taking care of the medications, or the insurance is not taking care of all of the treatment program. We step in, we take care of the treatment program, or we fly a family out of state to take care of, you know, maybe finding a treatment program that is suited for the illness that their child has. They can't afford to get out of state. We take care of that. We put them up in a hotel. Or it's a food pantry that we run. We feed 400 families a week, make sure the kids don't go to bed hungry. Or whether it's to get a wheelchair, or like last week, we put a handicap accessible ramp on the side of a little ranch house that has a family that has an 11-year-old that's a quadriplegic, and we took care of that. Again, the insurance doesn't take care of that. We step in, and the whole mission statement, the whole idea of the foundation is to take care of these things directly without the people losing more than they lost already. They shouldn't lose their dignity. They shouldn't lose their pride. They shouldn't have to go through mountains of paperwork. We make sure that it's legitimate. We do our work. We do our due diligence, and then we act on it. And I think that was the thing that kind of stuck with me as a kid from my father, is that when he did all these house calls and he took care of all these people for free, he made sure that he understood about the human element of it. He didn't make them lose their pride. He always let them make him a cup of tea. He always let them give him a piece of cheesecake. You know, he had a little bit of a sweet tooth. And this way, they felt like they were giving something back, and they felt better about the service they were getting. And that's pretty much the way we run the foundation. We do it every day of the year. We probably get 20 to 30 cases a week. And we need people. We need the public out there to help us do what we do.
Tremendous stuff. Much smaller scale, a memorial foundation for my mother, you know, and I can really relate to this, that when you have a very meaningful person in your life like that, that you have to try to take this inspiration from it and run with it in that way. Of course, with your book, Atlas, From the Streets to the Ring, A Son's Struggle to Become a Man, I know you go into some detail in there about, as you went through the course of your life and some of the tribulations and everything, absorbing those lessons from your father and everything, and ultimately that helping you to become the kind of man that you are today.
Yeah, I hope I'm a decent man. You know, I care about other people. I care, of course, at home about my own family and trying to teach them the right things. And whatever good I do possess, and hopefully it's something of some substance, I did learn a lot of it from my father. And, you know, I think the best teacher is by example. And he wasn't a lecturer. He didn't talk a lot. I wish he did talk more, but he didn't. But he did things, and I saw them, and I was impressed by them. And I think through osmosis sometimes, you know, you absorb things. And when I would see him taking care of these people, one story that stuck with me, and again, he never ever talked about it, but I remember it was Christmas Eve, and the only way I could be with my father was to hang out in the office or do house calls. There was just no other way I could be with him because he wasn't around that much. So I'm in the office. It's pretty packed, and because he took care of everybody, so he had a very busy practice. And like I said, when you don't charge, you're going to get a lot of people that are going to come in your office. And he just took care of this young girl. She looked like a girl. She had about four kids, and she was very young. And it was obvious that she was alone, that she had no husband in her life. And he's taking care of them. And I remember he was giving them free medication because that's what he would do. He understood that a lot of these people, even though he treated them free, they couldn't fill the prescription. They didn't have the money. If they didn't have the money for the doctor, they definitely didn't have the money for the prescription. So he would go and he would give them free medication. And they were. I'm watching this girl, and I was young. I was probably around 11, 12 years old. And I'm watching, and I realize that she doesn't have money. And at some point, I realize that she's getting nervous as the end of the examination. He took care of all the kids. He took care of her. And she's getting nervous because she don't know how she's going to handle it. And before it got to that point, my father said, there's no charge today. And he knew that he was relieving her of what her conscience was telling her, am I going to run out of here? You know, how am I going to handle this? And he never let her get to that point. And then when she left, he's busy with a, you know, a whole bunch of patients, and he was like the absent-minded professor. All of a sudden, he says to me, you know, I'm not thinking it's Christmas Eve. He turns to me, he takes some money out, he gives me a $50 bill, and he said, go find her. She's probably on a bus stop because he realized that she probably didn't have a car, and go find her and give this to her. And that's all he said. And I remember I ran down there. I thought I was on a special mission. I couldn't wait to find her. I was looking all over the place, and there she was. I went around the corner, and she's at the bus stop, and I went up to her, and I said, the doctor said to give this to you. And she started crying, and that always stayed with me. And hopefully, like I said, if I do anything good, it's through those kind of lessons. Not talking, not speeches, but seeing that kind of living, that kind of behavior.
Well, that's tremendous, and that had to make you feel so good to be able to do something like that. And I'm curious on this vein of thought, Teddy, as far as the good in people and, you know, some of the complexities that come up sometimes here. I haven't seen in any of the research that I've done on you or anything that I've ever read about you, any of your thoughts. Being somebody who obviously knew Mike Tyson well in his formative years as you did with training and everything. Have you had any thoughts, even if you haven't seen this documentary in the last year or two, I know you've heard a lot about it. I don't know what your awareness of it is, but has there been anything that you've seen in that as far as this whole kind of stripped bare persona that we've seen of the man? Does it really stir anything in you or change any of your feelings about him, or are you kind of cynical about how he came across?
I'm not cynical. I think I try to be middle of the road. I think I'm honest about it, and I think I'm realistic about it. I mean, I did start him when he was 12 years old to the age of 16, so I know a little bit about him. I trained him every day, and I trained all the fighters for Customato at that point. I wound up walking away from him and from Cus because of the lack, what I thought was the lack of discipline with him that was going on, and the different standards that we were given to him and treatments that we were given to him compared to the other kids in the gym, and it was getting a little out of control. And I wound up walking away from there, and it was not a good situation when I walked away. I was forced to make a decision. I made a decision that at that time I thought I needed to. But looking at this, and it's not in any way, I don't think, anyway, I hope I'm good enough to control my emotions and say that it's not based on anything other than what I truly have seen and what I truly believe, is that he's always been a chameleon. He's always been a survivor. I mean, as a kid when he was 10, 11 years old, you know, he was robbing old ladies in the projects. He was 190 pounds when I got him. He was 12, and he was all muscle. So obviously he was phenomenal physically, not emotionally, but physically he was a pretty special specimen. But, you know, this is a guy that used to go into the projects in Brownsville there in a rough area, and he used to say to the old ladies, they'd be going to the elevators with you know, bags of groceries, and he'd say in that lispy voice, and you always wonder if that's where it started, because it was in a very, with a very, you know, soft, vulnerable, sort of a safe voice, and he would say, ma'am, can I help you with your groceries? And most of the time they would be glad, and they would go to give him the groceries, they get into the elevator, and he would knock them out, and he would steal their money. And he wound up going to jail, you know, at like the age of 12 for many of these offenses. And we wound up getting him out of Tryon, which was a juvenile detention center that he was in, which was 30 miles north of Albany. And, you know, he started the journey of becoming a champion, a prodigy, and a world champion fighter, the youngest at all time, less than 21 years of age. But during the course of the time, I always noticed about him that he was a guy that obviously had emotional problems, was a guy that had problems with authority, with rejection, with different things. We understood his background, and we did what we had to do to compensate for that and at the same time try to bring him up with the right amount of discipline and everything. But he was always a chameleon. He was always a guy that knew how to survive the moment. We found out that when he was a kid, he used to go into the abandoned buildings, and actually, he was picked on by all the toughs in the neighborhood. Actually, his nickname wasn't Iron Mike back then. It was Stinky Mike, because he didn't bathe, he smelled. People used to make fun of him. And he used to hide in between walls, because they were abandoned buildings. And just think about that for a minute, what that does to a human being, what does that does to a psyche, what does that do to a person. You know, his humanity. He's hiding in between walls as these tough guys are looking for him to beat him up. And then later on he becomes this fighter. And I always thought that he was the kind of guy, when he dealt with the press, he would talk real nice. And then when he was around a different kind of people, he would talk another way. He was, when he was getting ready to fight Lennox Lewis and different fighters, and he thought he had to intimidate him, he would say things like, I'm going to eat your children, I'm going to rip your heart out, I'm going to step on it. How dare you talk to me that way when you know I'll kill you for it? And I remember when he said those things, those words were very familiar. And then I realized where they came from. They came from comic books. They came from Superman, you know, movies, where Lex Luthor said, you know, I'll kill you for saying that, or I'll rip your heart out. And he took it from all these kind of places. He had no identity. You know, this is a guy that his identity would be what it had to be. He would say what he had to say for that moment. If he had to be good to a newspaper guy, yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Katz. Yes, Mr. Cosell. Whatever he had to say. And then when he had to act that way, he would act that way. So when I saw that documentary, it was nothing strange to me. To me, it was manipulation at its best. It was the same old Mike Tyson saying what he had to say to survive the moment. Now he doesn't have a career athletically anymore. He needs to get people to invest in him in a way where he can make some money in this way. And what does he do? Well, he acts like a chameleon, and he says exactly what needs to be said for that moment. So, again, you could say it's harsh, you could say it's sour grapes, but I tell you, honestly, it's just my experience with Mike Tyson that I'm saying that.
Well, I mean, those are great insights from somebody who obviously, you know, knows him very well. As you said, saw him in the formative years, and I've read another quote of yours where you were talking about this, about training Michael Moore to the heavyweight championship. Because it's funny, we've all got this alternative history in our heads, you know, of what would have happened if things hadn't gone off track and everything like that. And it had to be really great for you that you were able to train somebody to the heavyweight championship really on your own terms and not have to stay with somebody like Mike Tyson after it became past the point of being tolerable for you.
You never have to do anything. You know, we're pretty lucky. We're born in a country where, for the most part, you can make your own choices. You know, sometimes you got to live with those choices, too. But you can pretty much do what you believe you want to do. and to the extent that it's allowed, and to the extent that it's legal. And I made a choice to walk away from him. You know, I didn't want to be part of that. And doesn't make me a good guy, doesn't make me a bad guy. It just makes me a person that's what I was comfortable with. And I lived with that years after. And he lived with the choices he made with, you know, and he continued to make years later. But being able to have a moment where we were able to beat Evander Holyfield and Michael Moore was able to win the heavyweight title, that was a special moment for me, because it, to me, it kind of validated what my father did. My father allowed me to go upstate and train fighters for Custom Auto, and he paid for my room and board. It wasn't much. It was $50 a week back then, but you know what? I had nobody else to pay for it, and I didn't finish high school. I didn't go to college. And he allowed me to become a trainer. And here's a doctor. What must he have been thinking? He wanted me to be a lawyer. You know, a lot of people wanted me to be a doctor. And here I am. I'm becoming a boxing trainer. And the best thing about winning the heavyweight title with Michael Moore, it allowed me to do a lot of things for my family. But the best thing about it was, to me, that was graduation day. My father had just died, but I believe that somehow he was watching, and it was my way of being able to say, "Hey, Dad, you didn't get to go to a college graduation, and you know, I'm sorry you didn't, but you get to go to this graduation. I got the heavyweight champ of the world, and you know what? I understand how to live the right way. I understand how to behave like a man, and thank you."
Well, that's wow. I mean, that's a very poignant kind of capstone on that. That's I didn't know the full extent of that. That's a very emotional thing that had to have happened for you. I'm curious about your thoughts, Teddy. You know, as somebody who's obviously very well acquainted with the history of the game, and that goes without saying, it strikes me we've had a period here. You referenced before Tyson and Lewis, mid-'02. We've gone now about 8.5 years, as far as I can remember, without any kind of huge marquee heavyweight mainstream type fight. To me, that's as far as I can remember, that's the longest in the modern history of the game. You might have to go back to maybe the early part of the 20th century to find a similar drought there, and it doesn't seem to have any signs of abating at this point in time. It's always been said the heavyweight division is the engine, really, of the boxing industry and what drives a lot of the mainstream appeal. I know there have been a lot of, you know, fights over the last decade with De La Hoya and some of the other guys that have gotten attention, but it seems like over the long haul it's going to take a revival in the heavyweight division to make it happen. Is there anything that you can see that might bring that about in the course of the next decade or so?
Well, you know, the heavyweight division, you know, it went across seas. I mean, it went over to Russia. Mm-hmm. You know, it went to Europe. I mean, they have good amateur programs. They got hungry guys. They have disciplined guys. If you look at the NBA, and people are going to say, "Wow, Teddy, you're making a comparison of boxing and NBA." What I'm going to say is this. You look at some of the guys that come from Eastern Europe into the NBA, they're not as athletic as a lot of our guys that are over here. They're not as quick. They're not as good in certain areas. But they're disciplined. They know the game. They're technically taught well. They're good shooters. They play defense. And they behave like good teammates, like good, solid basketball players. They have the understanding of that philosophy. And it's allowed them to get to the NBA, and it's allowed a great influx, and I think most people listening would probably agree to a certain extent, that it's really allowed the Eastern European players to infiltrate the NBA to a greater extent than probably people ever thought it was going to happen. Well, guess what? It's for those reasons, and the same reason in boxing. America owned the heavyweight division. We had the best heavyweight division. Joe Louis, Rocky Marciano, you know, Sonny Liston, Muhammad Ali, Mike Tyson. We had them all. We don't have them no more. For the same reason. Because now, over in Russia, you have good amateur programs. You have discipline. You have guys that don't have a million options. They concentrate just on that. Their eye is on the ball. And they learn it the right way. They learn it from the bottom up, where they get 200, 300 amateur fights. They have the programs over there to be able to do that. And because of that, you've had an absence of heavyweight champions from America. Until we get better programs, more amateurs, we get better teachers, and we're able to develop the kids in the farm system, in the amateur system, no different than you got to develop guys. The Yankees have to have farm kids coming up all the time. You don't want to always go into free agents. Well, we got to have kids coming up from the amateurs. And until we do a better job with that, and again, until we get where they're concentrating on that, they're disciplined, their life is disciplined, because if you're not disciplined outside the ring, it's going to show up inside the ring. And a lot of these European fighters, they're a little better in those quarters.
Teddy, has MMA surpassed boxing in terms of popularity at this stage of the game?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Has MMA, mixed martial arts...
is MMA.
Yeah, has that surpassed the popularity that boxing once enjoyed?
You know, that's a fair question. It's a good question. And it's a question that I get asked quite a bit. My answer and my explanation is this. The answer is no. If you look at a big event... See, the problem with boxing, it's become a little bit of a niche sport. I got to be honest. And it's become an event-driven sport. When Pacquiao's fighting somebody, when De La Hoya used to be fighting somebody, when Mayweather was fighting somebody, everybody come out. It was like our own little Super Bowl. Maybe we had 2 Super Bowls, 3 Super Bowls a year, maybe. And everybody came out. All the movie stars, everybody, celebrities, the football players, the basketball players, everybody would come out. And it might do $100 to $150 million across the world in revenue. MMA, I respect that sport. I respect the hell out of those guys. They're tough, tough son of a guns. But they're not a pimple on the backside of boxing when it comes to that kind of revenue. The problem with boxing is, when does it do that? It does it once a year, once every 2 years,
right,
maybe twice a year, once in a while, when it's a big event. MMA, they do a much better job across the board of putting even match fights out there, competitive fights out, where every day of the month, once a month, every 2 weeks, whatever it is, you can see a good MMA, a good competitive MMA match. You can't say that of boxing. So they do a better job of promoting this sport. They do a tremendous job. Dana White, or whatever his name is, does a great job of marketing his sport. But when it comes down to the big moment, the big event, mm-hmm, again, they are a pimple on the backside of boxing.
Well, Teddy, it's interesting that Paul's question was about MMA, because that was what I was going to ask you about. This will be a follow-up then, based on what you said, because it seems to me the big advantage that MMA has got with the consolidation you've seen in the UFC, they don't have the alphabet soup type chaos that you have in boxing. I mean, Pacquiao and Mayweather, let's face it, if they were in UFC, that would have happened a year ago. I mean, you have a few outliers like Fedor and a few guys that are outside of it, but by and large, you get to see the big things you want to see in there. How can boxing eventually, and this has been the age-old thing, and it's only gotten worse over the decades here, can boxing have any kind of consolidation in the ranks to be able to compete on a more even footing in terms of the fights that everybody does want to see?
Yeah, it could. It won't. It should.
Yeah.
I wish it would, but, you know, you have Dana White. You have one power there. You have a guy sort of like NFL has a national commission, the commissioner, the baseball has a commissioner, basketball has a commissioner. Boxing doesn't have one centralized commissioner. They got all these BS state commissions that some of them have no teeth at all. It's ridiculous, and they have different rules all over the place. There's no unilateral conformity with the rules, and more importantly, with the enforcement of rules. And the enforcement of a standard of their product. And that's the thing that's missing. I mean, Dana White makes sure that the best guys are fighting the best guys, so the public is always going to be going out there to watch it. There's going to be interest. There's inspiration for the fan to go watch, because the best guys are fighting each other. There's nothing in place to make sure that happens in boxing. You have these separate power brokers, whether it's Don King or Bob Arum or any of these other guys that you want to name that are the flavors of the month, the flavors of the year that come along, and they're just taking care of themselves. They're not taking care of the sport. See, one thing about when you have one commission, you're making sure that the sport across the board is as healthy as possible and that the public, that the audience, the fans are going to be happy. That's not what these guys are doing. They're making sure that we get ours, that we take our guy, we maneuver them with our relationship. There's too many of these guys have relationships with HBO, with Showtime, and because of those relationships, they're buying their fights. They're not buying other fights. Because of their relations with the Alphabet organizations, the WBC, the WBA, the IBF, they're all corrupt. And because of their relationships, not the merit of what the fighter does, but their relationships, they're getting rated, and they're getting put into certain positions where the public, at the end of the day, is not getting the best matches possible out there. Now, if you had somebody that cared about the entirety of the sport and the entirety of all the fighters, well, then they could demand that there's a better system. But I don't see a national... I was fighting for a national commission with John McCain, Senator McCain from Arizona, years ago. And he tried a little bit, right, but it never came to fruition.
I think, Ted, for me, as a boxing fan as I am, the most frustrating thing for me is that I remember back in the 80s, no matter the weight class, there was always a great fight with great fighters. You had Salvador Sanchez, the late, great Salvador Sanchez, Alexis Arguello, Aaron Pryor. Those two fights were legendary. You had, obviously, the Mike Tysons. You had the Sugar Ray Leonards, the Thomas Hearns, the marvelous Marvin Hagler's. You know, my point is that back then, it didn't matter the weight class. They made special events, which is what MMA is doing now, and you don't see that anymore in boxing. And for me as a fan, it is amazingly frustrating because there are talents out there right now that 95% of the public don't even know exist that are on par with some of those names that I've just mentioned.
There's a lot of good fighters still out there, but unfortunately, they're not fighting top fighters where you're being able, as you just said, you're being able to see those fights and identify with those fights. There's not as many good fighters as there was years ago. I disagree with you with that a little bit, because there's not as many clubs, there's not as many, you know, places and gyms, not as many good teachers around, not as many fighters around, places to develop for those fighters. But there are plenty of good fighters, and they're not fighting the best guys. Now what the managers are doing, back in the old day, the manager would put them in fights to develop them as a fighter, to make them a real product, to make them a real professional fighter that could fit in with anybody in their division. But now they're doing it different. Now they're maneuvering. Now they're manipulating. Now they're navigating. They're taking their fighter and they're saying, if I get them 14 easy wins or 15 easy, they might not develop to be the best fighter they could be because they don't take a deep breath in a fight. They don't psychologically, mentally, you know, get tested where they can become more dependable and obviously a better fighter down the road. But they become 14-15-0, I get them on HBO. I get them on Showtime. You know, on ESPN, we take them before they get to those places. We do that on every Friday night. But these guys are looking to get to the places that pay, and HBO and Showtime are paying those kind of purses. So they're really, are they doing them an injustice? At the end of the day, I think they are. Instead of putting them in fights that maybe are 60-40 fights, instead of fights that are 90-10, where there's no chance they're going to lose, then they can become the kind of fighter where they can be around and fight good fighters in different weight classes for many years. But again, they fall short a lot of times because by the time they get to that point, yeah, they're going to get that payday. They might even get two to paydays. But they're not really going to have the depth and the development to stay around because, again, they're just their goal, the managers nowadays and the promoters nowadays, is build a record up, go to their friends at HBO, go to their friends at Showtime, put them on there, and plug in for a payday, but not really develop a fighter for the future.
Yeah, it's kind of sad the way that that happens. And as far as the fight game and the way that it's always kind of regenerating itself, I want to ask you about this because I know you've had a front row seat at the Olympics on NBC ever since 2000 in Sydney. And just kind of a side note, I've always got this running joke with a friend of mine how NBC, you know, they only do like a handful of core sports. They almost tend to use like the Kelly Temp Services model every 4 years. You know, they hire out all these guys from the other networks and bring in and have you doing the stuff there. And really, that's the only time they really need to do stuff with many of these other sports because of their existing TV deals. But with everything that you do at the Olympics, and I would assume that they've got you down for London in 2012, I'd just like to know about your overall experience every time you go to do these, both from what you're learning about the fighters when you're there. Do you get to take in much of the country and see the scenery? Is it like a, you know, a nice kind of aspect to kind of see the world? you know, the Olympic Village. What's one of these experiences typically like for you?
Well, I've done three Olympics now. I did the one in 2000 in Sydney, then I did Athens 2004, and then I did Beijing, which was pretty incredible. And there'll probably never be another one like that, because I don't see another country that could afford to do a spectacle like they did. I mean, you know, let's be honest. I mean, the way they run their country, they have a billion people that they don't have to care about their human rights, and that's a damn shame. But they can order them to do whatever they want them to do. And so, therefore, they can afford to put up structures. They can afford to put up unbelievable buildings and unbelievable spectacles that any other country can't do. So you're probably not going to see anything come close to that, and probably not going to see that in England in 2012. But what I was able to experience over those three Olympics is you're there to work, and it's a lot of work. And it's not a sprint. It's a marathon. And I don't know if there's any other sport, but I think boxing is on from the beginning to the end more consistently than any other sport, from the first day to the last day. We did, I think, 270 fights in the last Olympics. I mean, that's an extraordinary amount of fights, because for the first week and a half, you're doing day and night sessions. So you're doing wall-to-wall boxing, and you're just calling different countries and different names of fighters that I can't even pronounce, that somebody's helping me pronounce, and I'm still messing it up. But you just don't stop. And like I said, it's a marathon. And it can become where you get foggy, where you get, you know, it becomes almost too much. You have to keep your, it's a real test to your endurance mentally, where you keep your concentration up, and you have to remind yourself, you know what? It's easy to start thinking, well, this fighter from Bulgaria against this fighter from Ecuador, you know, what does it matter? It's the 40th fight I called in the last hour and a half, and you know what? Let's just go through the motions. And you got to remind yourself that every one of these fights matter, because they matter to somebody out there. And for me, that's how it worked. I reminded myself, listen, you're getting a little tired, forget about it. You call this fight like it's Ali Frazier, because for somebody, that's what it represents. And so it's your own little test of that kind of mental endurance when you're doing that many fights, that you remind yourself that they all count. The first couple of days you get to the site, you can go and you can go around. You go to Beijing, you go to Sydney, you go to Athens. You got a couple of days to, you know, you get there early, you get there for 3 weeks, so you get there maybe 6, maybe 7 days before the events start, but then you're going to have production meetings, you're going to have different seminars that you're going to have to go to. So you got a couple of days where you can go around and you can enjoy, you know, the country and be able to see the history and the things that are there. I enjoyed that in Athens. I enjoyed that in all the places. But then real quick, it becomes time to go to work. And once it becomes time to go to work, like I just tried to describe to the audience out there, you are working 24/7. I mean, you don't have time to go out and do anything else. And it's an experience where you get to appreciate the different cultures. You get to appreciate the different prides of people, how much boxing, sport in general, but how much the Olympics, and in this case, boxing, means to these people. I mean, some of these kids coming from some of these countries, if they win, they instantly. Matter of fact, some of these, it's the only sport that the country has representing them, because the country is so small and doesn't have the resources to send other athletes. So if you win a medal, a bronze, a silver, or a gold, you're instantaneously, you go from being a person that's very poor in a very small country to where you're a star overnight. A lot of the countries, they have stipends where they give $100,000 or maybe $200,000 if you win a gold medal. You get a movie deal. You get a commercial deal. You literally, you do, we talk about the great American story, you know, of being able to go, you know, from the bottom to the top overnight. Well, the Olympics provide that story for a lot of other countries in boxing.
Yeah, it's an amazing spectacle to watch, and it's got to be so cool to broadcast. And I know from when we've had Kenny Albert on, he's talked about how much, you know, Olympic hockey, that's been one of his favorite broadcasting gigs he's ever had. I mean, you guys who have gotten to cover the Olympics like this, it's got to be just one of the absolute pinnacle things here. Teddy, we always like to give everybody on the show a chance to plug their stuff here. We have up links here tonight to your website, dratlasfoundation.com. Of course, you got the Teddy Dinner coming up Staten Island here November 18th from 6 to 11 p.m. at the Hilton Garden Inn. The golf outing, Lotterette Golf Course on Staten Island Tuesday, September 20th. Please take it away. Anything else that the people should know about tonight?
The only thing that they should know is that anything that they give to the foundation, it is November 18th, our big dinner, our big fundraiser. We usually have 1,100 people. We get anywhere from 50 to 75 celebrities. We've had George Foreman, Sugar Ray Leonard there in the boxing world. This year we're going to have Dick Ebersole there. We're going to have Phil Simms, the great giant football player, and now he's a terrific commentator. We're going to have Goose Gossage, the great pitcher who just went into the Hall of Fame, used to pitch for the Yankees. We're going to have a bunch of the Sopranos there. We're going to have Twyla Tharp. We're going to have a little ladies' touch. Twyla Tharp, the great choreographer who right now on Broadway in New York has the musical Come Fly With Me with the Sinatra music going. She did Hair. She did Dancing, Singing in the Rain. So she's a terrific talent herself. And it's all for one thing. It's to get together so that we can help other people. And people that just simply put, and I can't put it any other way, that gets to a point more, they can't help themselves. And it's tough times right now. I understand that, and I ask for a lot. But you, most of us, it's not as tough as it is for these people. These people that are sick or have somebody in their home that's sick, and they're not able, you know, to take care of those people. They're not able to provide for those people. I'll tell one story. We had a kid. It was a kid that's mentally challenged, and he also had cancer. And he was 12 years old, and he was sleeping on a mattress, single mom, living in the projects, and sleeping on a mattress and going to chemo treatments during the day. And so somebody brought it to our attention. We decided to do a Dr. Atlas Foundation, a little home makeover. And while he was out to chemo, we went in there with a whole team of guys, good people, all volunteers with the foundation that provided what we had to provide. And we went in there and we painted the room up. We also took care of the rest of the apartment. We put a stereo system in the apartment. We helped him with the refrigerator. We did a few things. But for his room, we found out that he was a big pirate fan. So we got an artist that went there and painted a giant mural of the Pirates of the Caribbean. Really did a beautiful job. We put a bed in there. We put a stereo system in there. We put a color television in there. You know, we put a desk in there. And we waited for the kid because we're a little selfish. We want to be able to see the joy of the kids. And we waited, and when he came home and he saw that room, like he thought like a genie came out of a bottle. He couldn't quite understand how it happened. And he was hugging his mother, and he was whole happy, and his mother's telling him to thank me. And he's coming over, and he's thanking me. And when he calmed down, I told him, listen, it's not me, really. So he says, well, who is it? I said, it's a bunch of people that you're just going to have to trust me. There's a bunch of people out there that really care about you. They actually love you. And they told me to go and make sure that you would have all these things in your room so that you would be happy, you would feel good, and you'd be able to watch your favorite shows, and you'd be able to sleep on a nice, comfortable bed. So there's a bunch of people out there, always remember that, that care about you and that are thinking about you. And that's what the foundation represents, a bunch of people that allow us to go make a difference in somebody's life.
Oh, that's a tremendous story, Teddy. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, it kind of makes it a little hard to stay composed hearing something like that. That's a great story. It's a great example of what you do, and we're behind that 100%. We'll do whatever we can to help promote this thing now and going forward. And I have to say, through 122 episodes of our program, I mean, you're one of the strongest guests we've ever had. There's so many clip and save moments from this conversation with you tonight, Teddy. You're always welcome back, sir. We would love to have you back sometime. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for allowing me to talk about something that's important to me. And allowing that to happen. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Teddy. God bless. We'll continue to promote this for you. Thank you so much. The great Teddy Atlas, everybody, boxing broadcaster, trainer extraordinaire. I had high expectations, but I love whenever I have high expectations and they somehow still get surpassed.
May I use some wrestling vernacular?
Yeah.
There were many a shoot moments in that interview tonight.
Yeah.
He put it out there. He just said, look, they're corrupt. Boxing is corrupt.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy that's right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
This is a guy that's been to the pinnacle as far as a trainer goes.
Yeah.
He knows the deal.
Yeah.
He knows that there's scumbags like Don King and Bob Arum and everybody else in these alphabet soup organizations that are out there.
And that's, to me, that's the biggest thing, because I'm a pretty casual boxing fan. I'm a pretty casual MMA fan. I can't get invested as much because you're not even going to see the stuff anyways. Roy Jones Jr. had a great career. Maybe, what did he fight, like one or two guys along the way of
right.
any substance?
Right.
I mean, say what you will about UFC, you don't see that, and he conceded that as much. I mean, Fedor and one or two other guys are like the outliers. If you want to see big fights there, they happen.
Rick, I've been a boxing fan. I was a huge boxing fan since the Jerry Cooney, Larry Holmes pay-per-view fight. That was one of the first pay-per-view fights that I don't know if you remember back in the day.
Uh-huh.
The old Channel 61 had a pay-per-view service called Preview.
Yeah, okay.
And we got that at the house to specifically get the Holmes-Cooney fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hooked on boxing. The Alexis Arguello-Aaron Pryor matches that I referred to
mm-hmm.
when we were talking to Teddy. I mean, MMA has got all of that stuff every month.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what the weight class is. Now, are people going to get more hyped up for the heavyweights? Of course.
Right.
People want to see Brock Lesnar more than they're going to want to see a Tito Ortiz or whatever.
Right.
You know? But those lighter weights still draw revenue, and they still put on great matches in
right.
MMA. Back in the days of in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, you had fights like Pryor, Alexis Arguello, Salvador Sanchez, one of the greatest lightweight champions ever.
Right.
You know, and there are talents like that out there today.
Right.
And the public doesn't know about them. It's just a shame because it's such a mess out there, which Teddy alluded to.
It's the one commonality of MMA and boxing is that heavyweights move the needle like nobody else. And again, to give a quick promotion ahead to next week with the Pantheon, which we'll be devoting the entire show to except for fantasy, we did a past Pantheon. A perfect example of this. Somebody that I voted for the greatest MMA fighter of all time, he came up just short in what was some very spirited balloting last time, GSP. But he doesn't move the needle like the heavyweights do. Nobody's, I got to catch the latest George St. Pierre fight. You know, part of it is because he's been kind of dominant. But even aside from that,
mm-hmm.
Brock Lesnar was a pretty dominant heavyweight, and that didn't scare people away. People
right.
wanted to see him pound people and beat them up.